Thank you to George Gershwin and DeBose Hayward and Ira Gershwin. Because of them, it's always summertime, even in the wintertime, which is when we are having the conversation that we are inviting you to listen to. I'm Andrew Patner, your host and producer for Critical Thinking here on 98.7 WFMT and WFMT.com. We're going to be listening to music chosen by and talking with a man who I think is one of the most interesting people in Chicago and probably the most important Chicagoan, I'm going to say, that you might not know. But you'll know a lot more about him and you'll realize, oh, that's all the same person as we talk a bit. Walter E. Massey is president of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. It's one of many positions he's held here throughout the country and throughout the world, though I think he considers himself a Chicagoan after many years connected with the city. And the first work that he chose for us today, the Modern Jazz Quartet, the MJQ, from the last concert, which was the last concert in November of 1974, recorded live at Avery Fisher Hall in Lincoln Center. The MJQ, of course, was John Lewis, piano, Milt Jackson vibes, Percy Heath, bass, and Connie Kay on drums. It might seem obvious and not worth asking, but I'll ask anyway. How did you pick this cut, Mr. Massey, and what did the MJQ or what does the song mean for you?
Walter, please.
Okay.
I started out early playing the saxophone in middle school. In fact, I played in a rhythm and blues band then, but we tried to play jazz in Hattiesburg, and I played alto sax. It was called the Blue Gardenias. And we actually were a pretty good group.
Yeah,
we played for dances and concerts. And when I went to college, and I went early, I went out of the 10th grade, so I had visions of perhaps being a jazz musician.
Really?
Right. On the alto, but I soon learned that I could do mathematics better than I could improvise. But early on, I discovered modern jazz and cool jazz,
right.
It was called then in the 50s. And the MJQ, John Lewis, was one of the first groups that my colleagues and I really fell in love with.
It's so interesting today, kids of almost any background have access to almost any kind of music at the touch of a button. They probably don't even need to touch a button. They can just think it or something and it will appear on one of their devices. But there were really schools, I mean, as in who you ran with or whatever, that determined so much musically in the period that you're talking about. You were into jazz or you were into R&B or you were into classical for the most. I mean, there might be crossover among some musicians, but that was a kind of identity, wasn't it? That to make a choice, what was the music you were going to listen to or the music you were going to play?
That's true. And two things you bring to mind memories. It was not that easy to find jazz.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and there were very few stations that played it. So you had to sort of search for it or find someone who had a record, or there was a local music store that you could go and listen to. They should have these places, you might remember.
Yes.
You could go listen to the record before you bought it.
Right.
But there were even schools of jazz. There was West Coast,
right.
Cool School,
right.
And East Coast Jazz.
Right.
And
bop.
So that's true in bop, right.
Yeah.
And the MJQ was kind of a melding of this. Also, I first learned about classical music. I went to Morehouse College, and we had a teacher who taught art and music appreciation. And we would listen to classical music, and she would teach us how to follow a score and take us to concerts. I could read music because I had started out, I could play music. But it was also the MJQ's sort of combination of jazz and this classical sense that John Lewis really had throughout the years.
And it often included classical compositions, the Bach recordings and so on, where he could sense right away that these things are related, that there's a classical basis to jazz and an improvisational quality to at least certain aspects of classical music.
Exactly, exactly.
To what extent was Hattiesburg a place of black community as opposed to segregation, and segregation as opposed to black community, if that makes sense?
It does. It was rigidly segregated. It was American apartheid. So there were black communities and white communities. I went to an all-black school. There were colored and white drinking fountains, everything people have seen in movies of that era. I grew up with that. But there was also a black community, although we were colored then.
Right.
We were not yet black or
right.
African Americans. And there was a very strong community of blacks.
Mm-hmm.
So I had very good teachers in my schools, even though they were segregated. My mother was an elementary school principal. And so even though we were rigidly segregated in official ways and in social settings, the black community was very strong. And that's something I think many people don't realize when they picture segregation of that period. They sort of picture the black community as being totally subjugated within itself. And that was not true at all.
We'll come to that as we talk about many of the areas you've been involved with education and science and the role of education and bringing minorities into some of these fields. I was remembering as well, I can't remember exactly when the interview was, but at some point there was a well-known black woman entertainer who spent much of her career, as many did overseas. She was called Bricktop.
Oh, yes.
And she came back to the
Paris,
States.
Right.
She was in Paris for a long time.
Yeah.
And Studs Terkel was interviewing her. And, of course, he was trying to be up to the moment. And he'd say, "Now, you and other black singers." She said, "I'm not black." And he said, "Well, Negro. I'm not Negro." And she just went on. And she said, "When I was growing up in the 20s, if you called somebody black, that meant you wanted to fight them." You know, so it does, you know, the terms come and go, right?
But I'll tell you a quick story.
Please.
My wife, when she hears this, will laugh at that. My wife's mother was very fair. She looked white. My mm-hmm. wife was born here in Chicago, and she knows the old St. Luke's.
Mm-hmm.
Which was segregated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she was, and they put her mother in the white ward. And her father came, who is not fair skinned, and the hospital was horrified. They moved her out and they put on her birth certificate, my wife's birth certificate, black. And in 1942, that was an insult. As you just said, because you were Negro then. Right?
My goodness.
It's amazing how it was. I wrote an article once and gave a talk, and I titled it "From Being a Colored Person to a Person of Color."
Mm-hmm.
We started out colored, then we were Negro, then we were black, then we were Afro-Americans. And as I say, Jesse Jackson made us African Americans.
Right. That was his contribution
right.
to that sequence. That's for sure. Speaking of sequence, let's go to the next cut, and we'll just play it, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places. Where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life from jazz and cocktails. The girls I knew had sad and sullen gray faces with distant K-traces that used to be there. You could see where they'd been washed away by too many through the day. 12 o'clock tales. Then you came along with your siren song to tempt me to madness. I thought for a while that your poignant smile was tinged with the sadness of a great love for me. life is lonely again, and only last year everything seemed so sure. Now life is awful again, a trough full of hearts could only be a bore. A week in Paris will ease the bite of it. All I care is to smile in spite of it. I'll forget you, I will, while yet you are still burning inside my brain. Romance is much stifling those who strive. I'll live a lush life in some small dive, and there I'll be while I rot with the rest of those whose lives are lonely too. Stifling those who strive, I'll live a lush life in some small dive, and there I'll be while I rot with the rest of those who lives are lonely too.
From that famous encounter for the gentle side of John Coltrane between Johnny Hartman, Chicago's own, and John Coltrane, the gentle side thereof, Lush Life, the Billy Strayhorn ballad. John Coltrane, McCoy Tyner, Jimmy Garrison, and Elvin Jones backing up the recording, the singing there. Walter Massey, you were growing up in this community in Hattiesburg that was a supportive community and one that included people from a variety of classes, I suppose we could say that I don't know if the word positive should be put there, but one side of segregation in that period was that within the segregated community there were role models, there were people of all kinds of background, from poverty to riches, I would imagine. And your mother was a principal, But still, to wind up going into science was something that even today is not always the first pick or the first guess that somebody's going to do. How did it happen that you went off to college at 10th grade, and then what exposed you to what once you were at Morehouse?
Well, I just want to reinforce what you just said about the complexities of the Black community, which is something else that most people who are not from that era in that time, those situations may not recognize right. We had wealthy people. We knew them all, the four wealthy people, Dr. Smith, who owned the drugstore, mm-hmm. Reverend Woolert, who was rumored to be one of the few Blacks who actually could vote and had his spirit. So we had that. A very positive side of it, I saw and see in retrospect, the quality of the education I had was excellent. And one of the reasons, it's ironic, is because of segregation. Blacks could not attend graduate school at the University of Mississippi or Mississippi State or other white schools. And in order to sort of keep desegregation from occurring, the state of Mississippi would pay for the graduate education of Blacks outside. And so many teachers came to the University of Illinois, University of Chicago, Michigan. So we had, in some cases, the Black teachers were better educated than the white teachers.
Right.
So that was the positive side.
Sure.
It was sort of serendipitous that I got the scholarship. It was a Ford Foundation scholarship. Morehouse College and two or three other colleges were offering it to students who could pass an exam. It was a nationwide exam, and I just happened to take it. I didn't think of myself as very bright at all, but I received one of the scholarships.
And this was in the mid-1950s?
This was 1954.
1954, okay.
And they offered me the scholarship to come to Morehouse. Of course, there was a lot of debate within the family and whether I was too young to go and I should go, but my mother prevailed in that side of the argument. So I went off to Morehouse. I didn't know much about science at all because I left the 10th grade, but I'd always liked arithmetic then, wasn't math, then math. And when I got to Morehouse, we had wonderful teachers, and I had a marvelous chemistry teacher and a marvelous physics teacher, and they took me under their wing, and I fell in love with the science. One reason I liked physics is because it was a way to use the math to try to understand the world.
It's a reminder, isn't it, of the power that a teacher can have, a single teacher on a single student, and the importance when the connection's there, if the teacher is able to take a person on for the additional coaching and emotional support that's involved as well, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And another sign of the times that when I was in Morehouse in the 50s, Sabinus Hobach Christensen was my physics teacher's name. He was a Danish, white Danish professor, PhD from Harvard, who went to Morehouse to teach. And there were a cadre of whites who went south during that period, still do, but then, to teach in historically Black colleges and were really committed to the education of Blacks. And he became my mentor for life.
There is a show right now, and I think it's going to be up for a while, so it'll be up when people hear our program, at the DuSable Museum in Washington Park, just west of Hyde Park at 57th Street on the south side, that has to do with the refugee teachers from Europe, Jewish teachers and anti-fascist teachers who came over, and the ones who could not get work at the, quote, elite schools because they weren't as famous or many, of course, had quotas against Jews and so on. And these are the ones who wound up at the historically Black colleges as well as historically Black Howard University and Lincoln University up near Philadelphia, I guess,
right,
Chester.
Outside of Philadelphia.
And It's a special slice of a larger context, such as Professor Christensen you mentioned, but it's a fascinating story both about what the South was about at that time and how these teachers found homes. And then once they could go elsewhere, they almost all stayed at these colleges they had become a part of these communities and vice versa. But these were not people who'd gone there intentionally. These were people who were running for their lives and wound up not even knowing there was segregation. You know, they'd fled segregation of a different kind, hadn't even known what they were going to encounter in the state. So I mentioned that just as a parallel side, that the bottom line, as they say these days, though, is the power and the importance of education, regardless of background.
It's true. And we had some of those. One of my math teachers, we should call him Bokum, was, I think, Polish. But there was the other group who are Americans who were just so committed.
Right.
I mentioned earlier that I had a teacher who taught music and art appreciation, Ruth Werfel. She was in her 20s, young white Jewish woman from New York City. Mm. And she wanted to come south and teach at a historical
and
college.
And at all-male college.
Oh, that's interesting. Right?
That is really interesting.
Right. It's black male college. Right?
Wow. Yeah. Wow. We hear the term Morehouse Man. This was a school very much designed to develop leaders, praised and satirized from its early stages. If you read Invisible Man of Ellison, this model of shaping at the same time, of course, praised by training people who would give a focus to business, education, and so on. Are you a Morehouse Man in that way? I know you're an alumnus, but...
Well, as a Morehouse Man, I would say I'm insulted if you can't tell I'm a Morehouse Man.
I don't know. I would have said you were, but then I might have been upset.
No, I might have insulted you the wrong way. No, see, you can always tell a Morehouse Man, but not much.
Okay. So it was a shaping experience for you beyond the classroom as well.
I would not be where I am in life if I had not gone to Morehouse College. I mean, now, literally.
We should say that I really dug myself into a ditch, because not only is this the case according to Walter Massey, but we know that he went back to Morehouse because you were president of Morehouse College for 10 years.
12 years.
12 years, excuse
Correct.
Me. But we haven't gotten to that point of your right. career, because that came after so many other things. But we should mention at this point, before we go back to some more music, that in addition to a, quote, pure academic career, you have been a dean of a college, a provost of a college and university, director of the National Science Foundation, president of Morehouse. I'm leaving at least four or five things out, I'm sure.
Right.
And you've also had very important service, particularly in the current economic environment, in the business sector as well. I imagine drawing on the administrative skills and experiences you had picked up from these academic ties. And yet, here you are now at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, which perhaps in some ways takes us back to when you were thinking you might be an artist, you might be a musician.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. I hadn't, but that's right.
So maybe this is a good point then to play It Never Entered My Mind.
Thank you.
A Concord reissue of a Rudy Van Gelder remastering of an album he recorded for the Old Prestige label, for the album Working With the Miles Davis Quintet, Miles Davis Trumpet, John Coltrane. Nice to have John Coltrane backing you up. Red Garland Piano, Paul Chambers Bass, Philly Joe Jones Drums, the Rodgers and Hart Classic, It Never Entered My Mind, recorded back in 1956. Walter Massey, once you had elected to go in the math and science direction, what was your goal? To become a teacher, or were you already thinking you would go on to graduate school and go into academia or industry, or what was your thought?
Well, I had a job offer when I received my bachelor's to go work in math, actually at White Sands testing facility out in Nevada. And I was all set to go, but Christensen and President Benjamin Mays, who's a legendary president of Morehouse, asked me to stay on at Morehouse and teach a section of the first year physics because one of the other professors was going on sabbatical. So I stayed and did that, and that really, I think, hooked me on teaching. And then I decided to go on to graduate school.
You mentioned Benjamin Mays, a figure in education and in civil rights, who a legend and a giant. Was he an active daily presence on the campus, or was he having to go around raising money and so on? I mean, what kind of role did he play in the daily lives of you students?
He was there. He walked the campus, maybe not every day, but enough. We called him Buck Benny because he walked like a John Wayne, a John Wayne type swagger, always dressed, of course, in a suit and tie. And we had to go to what was called chapel every day, 9 to 9:30, and it most of these occasions, the whole freshman class, Benjamin Mays, President Mays, would address the class on issues of integrity, honesty, leadership, what it means to be a Morehouse man, you know, all of those things that we from Morehouse talk about. So when my wife and I say that because we'll talk later, we really have a team in these jobs. When we decided to accept the offer to go back to Morehouse as president, there was no residence on campus then. Ever since Benjamin Mays had left, the presidents had lived off campus. And so one of the conditions that I set with the board was that we would have to build a president's residence on campus so that, you know, we and I could be on campus with the students as Benjamin Mays was.
Benjamin Mays, did he have his doctorate from the Divinity School at the University of Chicago? Is that?
That's correct.
That's right. Okay. That's correct. That was my recollection somewhere in my mental files. And this kind of circle and centering that he, chapel, this was a part of colleges for many years, most American colleges, of course, being founded initially by religious denominations and so on. But also coming at it both from an academic angle, someone who would have gone to the more broad or even secular divinity school at Chicago, and also taking it then and using it for shaping people, whatever your creed might have been.
That's true. And the University of Chicago's influence at Morehouse was very strong in terms of the rigor that the university is really known for, University of Chicago. Was emphasized there, we had other professors. I mentioned a chemistry professor. His name was Henry McVeigh. Henry McVeigh produced more black PhDs in chemistry than any other professor, wow, faculty member in the United States before he died. He had his PhD in chemistry from the university.
as we who went there would call it.
Okay. I remember one of the proudest moments of his life, he said, is when I became director of Argonne and I was professor of physics at the University of Chicago, and I went back to Morehouse to give a talk.
Oh.
I mean, he was elated. He was about 80, and he lived to see, he was on the search committee, in fact, that's right, for me to be president. And he always said one of the proudest moments of his life. He died about a year after I went back as president. But yes, it was that combination of the values, integrity, Benjamin Mays's context, spirituality, but also coupled with academic rigor.
Wow. And something so needed throughout education today, regardless of geography or the history of a particular institution. You went on then to Washington University in St. Louis, is that right?
I actually went to Howard.
Oh, first you went to Howard.
Yeah, for a year. And then I went on to WashU. Mm-hmm. And one of the, WashU, Washington University in St. Louis. And one of the reasons I went there finally is that Dr. Christensen, my Morehouse mentor, recommended that I go there because he felt it would be a great department for physics, but also a nurturing department. That, you know, there weren't that many blacks in physics, people going into physics, and that turned out to be the case.
And science hasn't always been known for being a nurturing graduate environment, period, right? I mean, it's often been a sink or swim place, for, depending upon what school one attends or what department one has. So I imagine being a black student also would make it better to be somewhere where somebody would notice you other than what your lab report was and whether the person was having a tantrum at his students that day.
I think that's true. I think that's really true. And I've seen it over the course of my life. Some places are very cutthroat and don't particularly nurture and support students. They may see graduate students more as helping hands than as partners or future scientists. But WashU was not like that. And I had a wonderful thesis director there, mentor, Eugene Feinberg, who was another Christensen. So that worked out.
And what was your thesis? What was
my
your
thesis
area?
Was on the properties of a liquid helium at very low temperatures. It's has strange properties. It becomes something called a superfluid. It can flow without friction. So I did some theoretical calculations to try to understand the reasons behind the behavior of liquid helium at those temperatures.
Obviously, graduate school in a doctoral program is not a time where a person gets out of the lab very much. But what was it like going not so much north as maybe to a border area, you could say, but going from Morehouse and briefly at a year at Howard and going to St. Louis? Obviously, the repercussions of civil rights were going on in segregated towns such as St. Louis that were thought of themselves as northern towns as well.
Well, it was a shock to me, and it showed that I should have paid more attention to geography because I really had pictured St. Louis as being northern. Yeah. And I was very surprised in an unpleasant way to arrive there in 1961 to find that St. Louis was, it was legally desegregated, integrated, but it was not at all.
Yeah.
It was very difficult to find a place to stay near the university, to find a place to eat sometimes near the university. It changed gradually over the years, but it was a southern-minded segregated city. The university was great.
Right.
But the city, you know, had problems.
Yeah. And then what happens when you finish your PhD?
I came to Argonne. That's when I came to Chicago in 1966. My first job was as a postdoctoral researcher.
Maybe say a little something about what Argonne National Laboratory was and is.
Argonne was founded by the old Atomic Energy Commission to carry out nuclear research on nuclear reactors. It grew out of the Enrico Fermi experiments that took place on the Stagg Field at the University of Chicago. And so when the working reactors were needed to be designed, the experiments were moved to southwest of the city. It's about 20 miles southwest. It's now one of the nation's largest national research laboratories, researching in all forms of energy and basic science, about 3,500 scientists and engineers and staff.
So it grew out of the, shall we say, peaceful side of the development of nuclear energy, and some of the labs down in the southwest of the U.S. were initially working on weaponry, but eventually, of course, turned to other things. But this grew out of the Atomic Energy Commission side of let's find peaceful uses for
these. That's true. Argonne was the first national lab. So, right, the reactors came along, and Los Alamos was specialized in the weapons development. That's where the bomb was invented. Oak Ridge in Tennessee did properties of materials.
Right.
And so the labs were divided. And so Argonne really has that tradition of, as you say, the energy uses of atomic energy for power production rather than for weapons.
And how long were you at Argonne then?
My first job there, I was there 2.5 years right. as a postdoctoral researcher, and I came back as director right. in 1979. And I was director for 5 years, and then I was vice president for research at the University of Chicago with responsibility for the lab.
When you had these experiences of going back to places where you had been a student or had worked, and now you were running them, I imagine many people in their minds, since most of us live Dilbert-like existences much of the time, wow, we can go back and get revenge. But my guess is that you were going back as someone who knew a lot about the institution from having worked there or studied there, but also who had a sense of how to continue and improve that institution, not to tear it down and start over.
Oh, that's certainly true. Yeah. That's certainly true. I mean, I was so pleased and honored to go back because in both cases, these were institutions, Morehouse and Argonne, that were so important in shaping my life. Morehouse as a person, and I think Argonne as a scientist, because I did some of my first research there after graduate school.
In between the first Argonne job and the return to Argonne, you started off in more pure academia, but you were quickly being tapped for committees and other assignments that brought you into deanships and administration as well.
That happened at Brown. My first real administrative job was dean of the college at Brown. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Mm-hmm. And that came about because at that time I had become very interested in science education. As opposed to doing research myself. And I was a theoretical physicist, so I did a lot of work by myself. And I didn't need a laboratory or laboratory assistants. Even before, I needed a big computer sometimes, but it was paper and pencil and mathematics. And so I didn't need to interact with a lot of people. And when I went to Urbana, after I left Argonne, I became very interested in science education. Then I went to Brown and helped start a program there to try to educate students to be science teachers in inner-city schools. And that brought me to the attention of the faculty and the administration at Brown. I think is that what happened. And then they asked me to be dean of the college.
That's a good point for us to break as well in this first part of this fascinating discussion with Walter Massey, now president of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. But he's, as you've heard, he's also been president of Morehouse College, and he's been director of Argonne National Laboratory. The National Science Foundation will come to that, and many other institutions as well. And this is something I've wanted to do for years, and it just finally has come together, maybe because of a recent mailing I got from the School of the Art Institute. But we're also listening to music, and since we're going to be back to fill you in more about Walter Massey next time, we'll go out more with music he's selected. And Bill Evans, Waltz for Debbie. Do you want to say anything about that before we go out?
It's absolutely the favorite song for me and my wife.
Well,
Waltz for Debbie and Bill Evans.
Thank you.
Bill Evans Trio with Scott LaFaro bass and Paul Motian, M-O-T-I-A-N, on drums, recorded live in New York back in 1961. A very young and impossibly talented Bill Evans, whom we lost at the age of only 51 some years after that, often playing here in Chicago as well. The last choice for this hour with Walter Massey. We want to thank Walter Massey for coming in today, and you'll be hearing him again next week as we continue his life story and his musical selections. We want to thank Matt DeStefano for putting the program together with us and making it sound great, our funder, Alpha Wood Foundation, and other funders and friends of this program. Drop us a line anytime. Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, or visit WFMT's Facebook page on Facebook, WFMT. WFMT.com/critical thinking is where you can find this or any of our other programs on the always free Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.